Event is a continuation of Rothko Chapel's educational meditation series, 12 Moments, Experiencing Spiritual and Faith.
Signals. It is Thursday, 10 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston that is devoted entirely to storytelling. Right here on listener-sponsored KPFT, 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville, not to mention live streaming on kpft.org. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Edgerton, Professor of Pathology at MD Anderson, and every week, along with my fellow hosts, Hank Rubicek, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, and interns Nicole Grady and Alondra Mejia, we celebrate storytelling with our guests, and importantly, our listeners, tuning in to experience the power and richness of a story. And having used that word celebrate, let me point out that this week we are celebrating two birthdays, Greg Audell and Nicole Grady. So happy birthday, guys. Now, first, I want to thank all the listeners who tuned in last month, which was my inaugural show. I really appreciate your support. And now I'm going to introduce my storyteller in just a few more minutes, but I want to just say something about storytelling. Each week, here at 90.1 KPFT, we devote the show to the ancient art of storytelling. Last week, I told you that storytelling was more than an ancient art. It's a social phenomenon that unites us. Tonight and every Thursday, we're here to show our connection as members of our world community. I like to reflect the season in the theme for the show. This month opened with Labor Day, and so tonight we will hear stories about the 1966 farmworker strike in South Texas. 2016 marks the 50th anniversary of the strike, which played out over the spring, summer, and on into the fall in my hometown of Rio Grande City. I have invited John Edgerton, a geophysicist with Ballard Exploration here in Houston, to share with us stories he remembers of the strike from the point of view of a 12-year-old growing up in a small remote town, the third poorest county in the USA then, population about 5,000, and the main source of jobs were the local farms. The community was, and still is, 97% Hispanic. It sits on the border, and I can tell you it is hot, hotter than Houston in the summer. Since the major employer was the big farms, many of the population were migrant farm workers. Okay, and I'm just going to break away here. Full confession, John is my older brother. And John, I'm going to share with our audience that in 1966, our family had been without a television for 3 years. So news for us was live on the streets as it happened. Our town newspaper only came out once a week, and the local TV stations were 50 to 100 miles away. Storytelling was actually how news was disseminated in town. So, John, take us back to 1966.
Well, thanks, sister. Thanks for having me on your show. My story begins 50 years ago in Rio Grande City. Every year in late May and early June, the cantaloupe harvest began, and the cantaloupe harvest was an important deal for the farmers. It was their main cash crop. Cantaloupes were harvested by hand, and so farm workers would flock to the fields and work. Unfortunately, they were all being paid about 40 cents an hour at the time. There was a group of organizers who decided that they would like better wages, so they formed a small farm workers union and started organizing a strike for that season. Cesar Chavez heard about it and sent one of his organizers, Eugene Nelson, to help out. since the harvest was only going to last about 2 weeks, they had to have a quick start to the strike. Now, also at the time in Rio Grande City, politics were controlled by a single political party. Back in the day, it was called the New Party. And they controlled everything from the judges to the county attorney to the sheriff's department. So the New Party supported the farms and not the strikers. And so the strikers had that against them, having to fight the county politics. At the time, there was an ordinance that the politicians set up that banned picketing for 10 days. And, of course, that was going to be most of the cantaloupe harvest. So the strikers would be picketing a farm. The sheriffs would come out to arrest them. They'd scatter. They'd go organize somewhere else and start picketing again. I was 12 years old, and I was working at a little fruit stand on the side of the highway with one of my neighbors. We had a fantastic front row seat to the entire strike. The courthouse was off to the left of us a couple of miles, and all the fields that they were harvesting were off to the right. So we watched the sheriff's department run back and forth. We watched the strikers parade up and down the streets, waving their flags and their banners. Viva la huelga was their slogan. And every once in a while, people would stop by. Our little fruit stand kind of became a little center for news. People would come in and tell us what was going on. We would spread the news to other people. It was pretty exciting. Then the Texas Rangers showed up. The Rangers were led by Captain A.Y. Alley. He was classic Texas Ranger. He was called one of the old school riot busting Rangers from the 1950s, a big man with a big hat and a big cigar. When the Rangers showed up, things took a more serious tone. One day, a group of strikers came into our fruit stand and bought a couple of cantaloupes, smashed them against a tree and started eating them, and started convincing us to, every time the Rangers drove by, to yell, Viva la huelga, you know, long live the strike, or Abajo los Rinches, down with the Rangers. The Rangers, of course, started arresting people. There were a lot of bogus arrests. There was arrests for disturbing the peace, for yelling Viva la Huelga, bogus arrests for resisting arrest. And then they were still trying to break the strike, and there was actually an incident where a bunch of strikers, picketers, were sprayed with insecticide. The strike ultimately didn't have an effect that year because the growers were able to import workers from across the river in Mexico. The county was issuing day passes for Mexican nationals to come across the river and work in the fields, and they were more than willing to work for the 40 cents an hour. So for the rest of the harvest season, because of the ban on picketing and the imported labor, the strike didn't really have that much of an effect. But the union kept up its activity for the rest of the year. There were other crops to harvest. Some of the incidents that happened later on that year, for example, in June, to get support for the strikers, Eugene Nelson organized a march of farm workers from Rio Grande City to Austin. A lot of supporters came in from Austin and other areas in the state, and it was 1966, so a lot of these kids were from the University of Texas, and they were kind of the beginning of the hippies. So the town was suddenly invaded by busloads of these hippies from Austin. And, of course, we had to go out and see them all. We were really curious what they looked like. The march actually started at the courthouse and marched right past our house in Rio Grande City. And I can remember hanging out in our front, on the front sidewalk in front of our house, as hundreds of farm workers, hippies from Austin, marched by carrying banners, shouting slogans. They actually marched from Rio Grande City through Corpus Christi to San Antonio and ended up on the Capitol steps in Austin on Labor Day, where Cesar Chavez actually met them. And they tried to gain a lot of support that way. Also, in October, I believe, of that year, Eugene Nelson, who was their organizer, along with Tony Orendain and another guy, I don't remember.
Chandler,
that's right, Chandler. They were called the three outside agitators. In order to try and stop some of the influx of labor from Mexico, went to Roma, Texas, where there was an international bridge crossing the river to Miguel Alemán, and actually blockaded the bridge to try and stop traffic from coming across. They stood in the middle of the bridge where the international line was, stopped the traffic, and if the Mexican police came out to get them, they would jump across to the U.S. side. The U.S. police came out to get them, they would jump across to the Mexico side. And this went on for several hours until finally the Rangers, of course, showed up and drug them all off to jail. Also that year, there was a blockade of a freight train carrying produce from Rio Grande to the valley. And I remember, and you might remember this too, sister, that we got a call from someone that Eugene Nelson was blocking the train. And so we actually went down there to watch it. And Eugene Nelson, along with several picketers, had this train stopped. And Eugene Nelson had his foot on the railroad track in front of the train to keep it from moving. He actually had the train stopped for several hours before, again, the Rangers showed up and drug him off to jail again for that incident. Now, the train didn't get very far because there's a railroad trestle right on the east side of Rio Grande City, and someone set it on fire. The thing was blazing, and I actually do remember driving out there and watching that for a little while as a 12-year-old kid. So the burning of the train trestle kind of ended the union's activity. I don't think the union did it, but they were blamed for it. Kind of ended the whole strike thing for 1966. Eugene Nelson, the outside agitators, were all arrested for it, but charges were later dropped. And I don't think anyone was ever actually convicted of burning the train trestle.
So that story really takes me way back, because one thing I do remember is we would get that call, the hippies are here, and my mother would load us up in the car and we'd go over and stare at these people, hippies. And then we got the call about Eugene Nelson, you know, holding up the train tracks, but holding up the train on the tracks, and the trestle. To this day, what people blame it on...
The union was blamed by the county attorney. In fact, he's the one who told him he was all going to arrest him after the election. The union always thought that the county had burned it. Some of the politicians had burned it to try and set him up for the blame. But actually, no one was ever convicted of it.
Yes, that's one of my questions when I die, to say, who actually burned down
the trestle?
Who burnt the trestle? Okay, John, thanks for that first part of that story. Listeners, hold on for the second half of our show with John telling us some more about the strike as it continued into 1967. But first, let's hear from Nicole about our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild.
Well, great news. The Houston Storytellers Guild is back from its August break. It will resume its normal schedule this month, and it's meeting the fourth Tuesday night. That is right, the fourth Tuesday night from 7 to 8:30 p.m.
Okay, and so, Nicole, can you give us a location for that meeting?
I sure can. As you remember, as a result of the fire at the Printers Museum, the Houston Storytellers Guild has moved to a brand new location, and that's the Haven Center at 1805 West Alabama, right here in Montrose. The next meeting will actually be this coming Tuesday, September 27th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m., so be sure to check out their site at www.houstonstorytellers.org for all the latest updates.
Well, I'm so happy they have found a new location, and they're only a few more days until they're back online. Houston Storytellers Guild is one of the most active and vital local storytelling organizations in the U.S., so let's be there to welcome them back. And I mentioned last time I was on the air that I joined. This is a great venue for the storyteller within you to be discovered.
And, you know, there's another exciting storytelling venue. And, you know, it's right here in Houston as well. It's the Houston Moth Story Slam. And that's the second Tuesday night of each month at Warehouse Live. The Moth is produced by our very good friend, Miss Elizabeth Sosa Bailey, with the one, the only, Dusty Rhodes as host, and features many of our storytellers, the hosts that you hear right here on the show. Now, of course, they just celebrated their 3-year Mothiversary in September, and in October, the theme is Busted. That's right, guys, Busted. So they are on generally the first or second Tuesday of the month, and you can find out all of the latest happenings, the Houston show schedule of events at www.themoth.org.
Yes, ma'am. Dusty Rhodes is inimitable for sure. And now how about telling our listeners how to find out about our own show? So what's your story here at 90.1 KPFT?
Well, you know, we have our very own Facebook page, and there you can friend us, like us, post photos, and just tell us what exactly you're thinking. Tell us what you're thinking, guys. That's right. Tell us what you're thinking and give us ideas for guests and suggestions for other storytelling venues as well.
So I have to say, friends of mine ask me, can I call into your show? And I say, you know, we're in the 21st century. Go to Facebook. Type in, so what's your story? And join our social network. Read about us. Communicate with us. That's your call-in medium. And keep up to date with information about the weekly show, which I think is just brilliant. So give it a thumbs up.
One last thing, Miss Mary. I don't know if all of our listeners, our great, fabulous friends out there, know about our brand new Instagram page, So What's Your Story? So follow us, guys. Follow us there. So next week, guys, on September 29th, Warren will be here hosting Ernie Turney, a member of the Houston Storytellers Guild and pastor of Bering Memorial United Methodist Church, just a few blocks away from our studio here in Montrose. And Mary, you know what September 29th means.
Oh, yes, ma'am, I do. We start our fundraising again. We are a listener-driven station, and so we depend upon donations to keep us going. So, storytelling fans, call in during Warren's show and let us know how much you appreciate So What's Your Story with a donation, no matter how big or little. Those little ones add up. And remember, you are listening to listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and for those of you further away from Houston, you're listening to live streaming at kpft.org. Thank you, Nicole. And now, John, take us to season 2 of the Farm Worker Strike.
Okay. So, 1967, as the cantaloupe harvest was gearing up, the union was organizing another strike for that year. And again, of course, all the characters were there. The Rangers were in town, and the picketing was going on. The Rangers were kind of singling out some people that they thought were subversive and actually invaded a home of one of the strikers and beat him up pretty badly. Actually sent him to the hospital. They claimed that they had seen him walking around town with a gun earlier. This brutality got some national news, some national attention. And so Washington sent down a Senate subcommittee to kind of investigate what was going on in South Texas with migratory labor and with the strike. They sent four U.S. senators to have a hearing in the Starr County Courthouse. One of them was Ted Kennedy. And in South Texas, the Kennedys are gods, basically. Every house has a picture of John Kennedy next to their picture of Jesus. So the hearing took place at the county courthouse in June, 100 plus degrees, no air conditioning, of course. The place was packed. There was everybody in town wanted to be there. I remember being standing around outside with my dad to let the people outside hear what was going on inside. They had microphones and speakers put around the courthouse so that the hearing could be broadcast to the population outside. But so many of the people in Rio Grande City are only speak Spanish, so they had a translator. And I remember being bilingual, listening to the English version and then listening to the Spanish translation, and the Spanish part was considerably embellished. The strike never really had that much effect on the growers. They never could get over the influx of workers, day workers coming in from Mexico. But actually what kind of ended the strike overall was that fall, or actually I guess in September, a major hurricane hit the Rio Grande Valley, Hurricane Beulah. When Hurricane Beulah hit, it kind of just hung over the valley. And I remember it rained 25 inches in Rio Grande City during a three-day period. The Rio Grande River swelled to about 5 miles wide. There was a town across the river from Rio Grande City, Camargo, and all the 10,000 residents of Camargo were evacuated by helicopter into our town. They occupied schools, churches, hospitals. The Red Cross was there. The Army was down there. I think we were out of school for about 3 weeks. So it was a great time to be a 12-year-old kid, 13-year-old kid. We rode our bikes around. We had a lot of fun. We chased the soldiers around. They would give us sea rations. We'd go back to our, you know, little hideaways and open the cans of fruit cocktail and tuna fish. And the sea rations always came with a pack of four cigarettes, which, of course, we smoked. After about 3 weeks, the water receded. And the Army was airlifting the entire population of Camargo back to their town. So they brought in the large Army Chinook helicopters, which I don't know how many people they carried, but they're big. I was standing at the parade field of our high school, which was an old Army fort, with a buddy of mine. We're watching these helicopters land, loading up people and supplies and flying off to Mexico. And I talked to my friend, and I said, we need to get a ride on one of those things. So the next one landed right in front of us. We ran out there, picked up some boxes of stuff, and jumped on the helicopter and sat down with all a bunch of residents from Camargo. And of course, they shut the back door. Off we go. I'd never flown in anything before in my life, and here I was in this Chinook helicopter going off to Mexico. We landed maybe 5 miles into Mexico on a highway, and we unloaded all the supplies. And as they were starting to close the doors on that thing, and my buddy and I went up to the soldiers and said, hey, we're Americans. We belong back in the United States. So the soldier let us in, flew us back. We landed back in the parade field. And as we got off the helicopter, he said, once is enough. Don't do it again. Don't do it again. I didn't realize it at the time, but my parents were actually out there on the parade field that day and saw me get on the helicopter and saw it take off. And my dad told my mom, well, I guess he'll figure out how to get home. But that hurricane has kind of reset the whole labor issue in the valley. The farms were out of business for a couple of years. Everybody kind of had to reset and regroup. And when the farming started up again a couple years later, wages were better. People were making more money per hour out there. I remember I worked in the packing shed for $1.60 an hour, I think, a couple of years after that. So the strike was basically over. The union was still active, but the strike was over.
Wow. You know, That's quite a story. I do remember the day after that deluge of rain, waking up and the sky was filled with helicopters going over to Mexico and coming back and going over to Mexico and coming back. It was just, and if you remember, if we saw a vapor trail in the yard while we were playing baseball, everything stopped while we stopped and stared at it, because you'd only see a vapor trail maybe once every 5 years.
Anything flying was of interest.
So yes, well, that was quite a story. So, but John, let's talk a little bit about Rio Grande City and Camargo, the little town in Mexico. I mean, what? So when it flooded, was there a lot of damage?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The Camargo, of course, is an ancient town. Adobe houses, dirt streets. Actually, Rio Grande City, I think at the time, only had two or three paved streets. It was all dirt streets, so it was just a big muddy mess. The river was actually a block away from our house, so yes, there was a lot of damage.
And you still go down pretty often.
Yes, I go to Rio Grande City a lot. Yeah.
And do you think it's changed much since then?
In some ways it has. It's got fast food now, which we didn't have back then, of course.
We didn't have pizza till we were about 12 years old.
But, you know, some things are the same. You know, the cantaloupes are still planted in February, and they're still harvested by hand in June. And so that still goes on down there.
You know, the other thing, and you sparked my interest when you said you wanted to talk about the farm worker strike, and I went in online. You know, there really is a lot of literature about it. What did you find when you looked into
it? Yeah, I found a lot of stuff on the internet about it. I found a great photographic essay of the farm worker strike. I found that there had been a ceremony this year in Rio Grande City in June commemorating the farm worker strike and a march, and some of the original strikers and marchers were involved in it. I found a wonderful essay about Tony Orendain, who was Cesar Chavez's lieutenant that he sent in to help Eugene Nelson organize the strike. Yeah, there's quite a bit of stuff on the internet on it to read about.
And, you know, the other thing to realize is, in Starr County, there were two high schools, Roma, which was very small, and our high school, which everybody, we were townies, I guess, we were townspeople, but all the farming communities went to our high school. And so let's talk about when the migrant farm workers would leave, they would leave around October and then come back. They would leave around March and not come back till October.
Right. So the migrant farm workers had a shorter school year. They would leave and go up and follow basically the crops all the way up to Washington State where they picked apples. I would like to say, though, that as much fun as I had as a 12-year-old kid during the strike and during the hurricane and the flood, the reality is that there was a lot of hardship and suffering going on in both Rio Grande City and Camargo amongst the populations. And so as much fun as I had, it was actually a very serious thing, and I don't take it lightly.
Okay. Well, John, thank you very much. Thanks for the perspective from the viewpoint of a 12-year-old, and then now your retrospective perspective. So Scooter is next with the inner side to complete the backside of this Power Hour on KPFT. So make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday here at 10 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And ease into the weekend. But for now, just remember, and this is one of my favorite lines of the show, it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Experience freedom and renewal through meditation at the Rothko Chapel. Samani Vikas Pragya and Samani Mariada Pragya will be leading a guided Jain meditation at noon on Wednesday, October 5th at the Rothko Chapel, located at 3900 Yupon. Suggested donation is...
Don't be late for this very important date. The Woodlands Children's Museum invites children ages 2 through 7 to a Mad Hatter tea party. Guests will enjoy sipping tea and making curious and curiouser art projects. And of course, your favorite Alice in Wonderland characters will be in attendance. So come to the museum anytime between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. on Friday, October 7th. The tea party is included with the price of admission. To learn more, visit woodlandschildrenmuseum.org. This is KPFT Houston. The party is included with the price of admission. To learn more, visit woodlandschildrenmuseum.org. This is KPFT Houston.